Hi, everybody. It's the Retro Computing Roundtable, Show 8.
But no matter where I go, this is one thing I like to know. Will I ever find my way back to Oz?
I'm your host, David Grealish from Johns Creek, Georgia. The RCR is your source of vintage computer news, views, and auctions with your favorite panelists within the community of computer history and nostalgia. We're back. It's a whole month since the last session, but the next one will be in just 2 weeks, putting us back in proper schedule. I'll talk about why I had to move the show back a week in just a little bit. So first, before I introduce our panelists, I have a big announcement, which includes one of our panelists, Carrington Vanston, who has been somewhat of a regular, but I have now signed on, if you will, two regular panelists, one being Carrington Vanston, another is Earl Evans. So welcome, Carrington.
Hello.
And so basically how this is going to work is, we record a session, a show about every 3 weeks, so Carrington and Earl will take turns becoming regular panelists.
Yeah, I'm looking forward to it. I really enjoy doing this.
And thanks very much. So Carrington is from Toronto, Ontario, Canada. He is the host of 1 Megahertz, the Apple II podcast. And Carrington, I hadn't told you this yet, but now as a regular panelist, you're going to be providing all of the musical entertainment between segments from now on.
Just like that.
A real talk show. So I hope that's going to be all right for you.
It's going to be all right for me. It's not going to be all right for your listeners.
So welcome back. And so what's new with you? Anything?
Nothing much. Still doing the podcasting stuff. 1 Megahertz is 3 episodes in the pipeline now that are sort of awaiting sponsorship approval, which is a bit of a pain. But one should be out later today. I just got email about it, so I can release it. So that's good. So by the time people hear this, I'll finally have a new show out.
Cool.
Yeah.
We're dying for it. That's good to hear. I didn't want to put the heat under you too much asking about
No, it's all good. I've been starting to pre-record a bunch of segments where people are coming over to my place and we're playing games together, games that meant a lot to them as kids on vintage Apple II systems, and then we record the sessions. And those are going
great.
Really well and really fun, so they'll be sort of regular segments in forthcoming 1 Megahertz shows.
Oh, that sounds great. Like a really nice additional sort of thing to it. Okay. Oh, what have you messed with any, have you messed around with any, I guess you have, because you sort of said, but have you had your hands on any old computers lately?
No, just the Apple II stuff, the typical old computer things. So I've got my own Apple II systems that I use regularly, but that's it. Nothing new and exciting sort of in the barn.
Okay. So now we move to James Savage, who is from Niceville, Florida. He's the co-host of the Retro MacCast podcast. And today was show 197, James, so that means you're coming up on 200 really quick.
Yes.
In 3 weeks, I guess.
if we stay on schedule.
Mm-hmm. As far as you know, you will be, I guess?
As far as I know.
That is quite an accomplishment.
It's an amazing accomplishment.
It is.
Just, if you keep it up, you can, you'll catch up to Buzz Out Loud.
Well, how many do they have? Thousands?
I think they're up to 1,500 or something crazy, because they do it almost every day, every weekday.
See.
But yeah,
tortoise in the hair, you'll get there.
No, I mean, seriously, 200 is fantastic. So, needless to say, the Retro MacCast is one of my favorite podcasts, always a first listen when it comes up. So,
thank you.
I didn't realize this is only your second time. This is your first time coming back on the show. I guess we had some scheduling conflicts, so I'm really glad that you're back on the show.
Well, it's good to be back. Thank you. Well, you've had
John,
my cohort, a couple of times, I think.
Yeah,
right?
Twice for John. Got a little notebook here. So John twice and Derek.
Derek, friend of the Retro MacCast.
Right, on twice too.
Okay.
So they're regulars.
I think we're well represented.
Right.
And it's a great show. I have listened to every one of your episodes.
Oh, thanks.
Fantastic show.
I'm pleased to hear that.
Maybe
we'll keep going.
I hope so.
I need that kind of encouragement every once in a while.
I don't, James, you don't think maybe you should stop while you're ahead?
Am I ahead? I don't know.
No, I said you don't think you should stop while you're ahead. Go out on the strong note.
Oh.
Before it starts, the decline starts, like good television shows and such.
Yeah, I guess.
Yeah, I'm only kidding.
I guess as soon as when I get Ted McGinley to co-host, I think it'll be over.
And have you
that joke.
Have you messed around with anything sort of
I'm sorry?
Have you had your hands on anything interesting recently or messed around, tooled around with anything?
Let's see. No, I mean, I've got so many unfinished projects, nothing that I'm like actively doing right now. I mean, let's see, lately I've just been playing around with, I think we're going to talk about this later, but emulators, you know, on the iPad.
Oh, okay.
That's a great way to experience retro systems is through the iPad, like ActiveGS. I don't know if you've talked about that on your show.
I got it recently, you know, since I got an iPad recently, but I'm not sure, but certainly something we can talk about. As we talked before the show, we're going to have a segment about emulators, so that's awesome. That fits right in. I even had a problem with the ActiveGS, so we'll talk about that.
Okay.
And see what, if you had any issues. So just to close out the sort of introductions here, this show was postponed 1 week from the normal 3 week session because last weekend I drove 100 miles to the Macon, Georgia area, you know, which is south of Atlanta, and I live 30 miles north of Atlanta, and for the Georgia Educational Technology Fair, which was a regional science fair from all the different schools around the greater Atlanta area. So that was kind of neat, and I'll have a blog post with some pictures very soon about that. So basically I just showed off a bunch of the collection, but it was a hit, so it was fun, a lot of kids. And you know, the funny thing is, I only had a few things actually plugged in. Most of it was just static machines, and the kids were constantly asking me, is this plugged in? Can I try it? And I was like, oh, no, I'm sorry. You know, I just didn't bring enough plugs and so on. Other things I'm up to is I'm the fourth chapter, Sanvit. I'm working on it. I'm almost done. It seems like I've been saying that for 2 months now, but just to put that out there. I do have a show planned for my video podcast, Classic Computing Number 3, featuring the Canon Navigator, which will be great. It's a very interesting computer. I wanted to announce something for the first time. I'm about to start something on Kickstarter.com. Either are you guys familiar with that?
Yeah, of course.
Sure.
Okay, well, I wasn't until recently. And actually,
that's exciting, though. What project are you starting?
Well, and you know, I heard about Kickstarter from Jason Scott, by the way, but I applied and I got approved. So basically, I just have to finish up the, you know, the different things you have to ready, and I have to do a little promo video. I used to publish a newsletter called Historically Brewed when I first started doing all this sort of stuff in computer history. So that was from between 1993 to like 97. I did 9 issues essentially. And so I'm going to reprint them into one book. And so basically I'm publishing a book. And the beginning of the book will have about 15 pages or so, which will be sort of my history, you know, talking about me and how I got started and, you know, where it went to and what happened in my collection. Just, you know, a little bit more about me in the beginning, and then basically just a reprint of all these issues because, you know, history doesn't change. They're great stories. It's good content, and it can get out there to a new audience. So I'm going to try to get some support, and you know, I haven't done this before, so I know that the lowest level would just be, hey, you think what I'm doing is cool, give me a dollar, up to, and I don't have it in front of me, but I think I'll have like a $75 level where if you, you know, donate $75, as soon as the book is published, you know, you'll get a signed copy of it from me. I have to kind of work out these details, obviously.
That's very exciting. Congratulations.
Thank you. And so, it, you know, my hope is that, or you know, someone at work keeps telling me hope is not a plan. So my intention is that raise enough money to, you know, to self-publish a very nice version of this. But anyway, so that's upcoming. And then, of course, I want to mention the every show until then, in approximately a little less than 2 months now, is the Vintage Computer Festival East 7.0, the 2011 show. And I think, Carrington, you're pretty sure you're going to that?
Yes, I am. I'm totally planning on getting down there. It'll be my first VCF East.
That'll be great. So I look forward to meeting you in person and hanging out. James, what do you think? Think you might try to make it? Or John? You and John? Or
Wow. I thought about it.
It's a Saturday.
I haven't pulled it out yet.
Saturday, May 14th, Sunday, May 15th in Wall Township, New Jersey, and which is, I don't know, 45 minutes or so, an hour from the Newark Airport. Okay, well, in case, put that out there. It works out perfectly with the schedule of shows. So, like, the next recording of this show is on the 2nd of April, then the 23rd, and then on the 14th of May. It would be the natural order of the next show, which will be Saturday at the Vintage Computer Festival. So, Carrington, you'll be there, so you can be on the show.
Yeah, fantastic. We can do it live.
And yeah. And I don't know, you know, I don't know if we can actually stream it live or any of that sort of stuff, but those are some interesting considerations too. So let's move on to our first item of interest and news. And basically I'm going to announce that, or they announced that 300 Baud, the magazine, shut down. So I know they were very behind on that third issue. So basically, they got the third issue out. I don't believe they've released it as a print version yet, but you can go to the website, The link's in the show notes, and you can download download all three issues in PDF format. So I highly recommend you check that out.
I think they announced that they were going to release a limited run of printed ones for the third issue. So if you did want to get one, you could keep your eye on that.
Mm-hmm. And I had purchased the first and the second one. I actually have an article in the second one, which I then reprinted in my blog with some updates. It's a fun little magazine. It's kind of a shame, you know, that it mm-hmm. went away. It's a lot of work, as I know, you know, trying to put together a printed, you know, periodical. But
and
I don't know.
It's tough to do once you add that expense in of the printing, because sometimes these things have very small readerships that are willing to sort of pony up the dollars. So it's really hard to make a go of it.
Just to see if you guys have opinions on this. I was kind of surprised even at its announcement, because, you know, it's easy to say print is dead. And I don't ever buy any magazines anymore, almost never.
That's why print is dead.
Yes, but I do go. I love going to the bookstore, and there's tons of magazines. Well, hey, you know what? That's not even true. I just bought a printed magazine. Here it is right here on my desk. In fact, Make. I bought a Make magazine.
Oh, Make is awesome.
About the Arduino revolution, because I want to do some stuff with mm-hmm. that. So, you know, I do buy a magazine occasionally. So Make is maybe an exception. And interestingly, 300 Baud is somewhat in the format of 2600, which still exists.
Mm-hmm.
So how is that possible? Why does 2600 still exist?
GS still exists, and that's a print publication.
Yes,
for
exactly. So what do you think some printed magazines can still make it? Or do you think 300 Baud could have made it?
Maybe.
Who knows?
It was a little more broadly focused. Hmm. And I think if you're going to go the small, you know, sort of handmade printed thing, hmm. being very focused, like saying, hey, we are all about Commodore, we are all about Apple, or we are all about something very specific, can maybe motivate people that are very keen on that particular niche
yeah.
to subscribe at a reasonable sort of level. I think if you go broad, then you better go, you know, retro gamer, sort of glossy and big. I don't know. It's a hard thing to do.
I think that's right. I think both of you guys with your very focused podcasts, which is not print, obviously, but it's kind of a mm-hmm. good example of that. Like the success of the Retro Maccast, in fact, James, because there's a huge Apple community and people are very focused on the Mac. So obviously a good area to focus on.
And I try to gather listeners that are very focused on their hatred of Commodore.
Yeah.
That's well
right, right.
Do you know if the folks behind 300 Baud are going to try to do this in another format?
Pretty much if you go to their website, which mm-hmm. I'm going to right now, it says three strikes and we're out.
Yeah.
It took almost a year, but yeah. It looks to me like, no, they're not going to, it's just they can't do it. So what does it say here? It turns out this publishing record is far more work than we thought.
Mm-hmm. Right.
And well, he took down the rest. Go ahead. I'm sorry.
Well, I just wondered if it says publishing record. I wonder if that's the doing the print magazine or the articles or what, because certainly they had a lot of good material that would work pretty good in a blog.
Yeah, mm-hmm. yeah. So we'll see what happens. Maybe Dale Goodfellow, one of the guys behind it, he's the guy in Scotland, and another guy was in Canada, I think, who did the actual printing.
Woohoo.
If I'm not mistaken. So maybe I can talk to him soon and see what their plans are.
Yeah, we have printing in Canada. We're good that way. We don't have science fairs. I was a little jealous of you going to one of those. I think it's mostly because we don't have science up here. We're mostly a magic-based society. So,
you have printing in Canada, Carrington? You don't know it's dead?
No. Well, it takes a while for things to die up here.
Yeah.
The cold, it preserves everything.
You guys hadn't heard yet?
Nope. It's all totally news to me.
Yeah, how come when they come out with movies about destruction and aliens and stuff, how come they don't ever destroy Canada?
Well, who would want to destroy Canada? We are nice. We go up to the aliens, we apologize.
Battle Toronto.
Exactly.
All right, well, let's go to the next item, which is about the Brain Board. So this is something, Carrington, you brought to our attention, so you go ahead.
Yeah, speaking of Apple II stuff, it's a new board that's just come out for Apple IIs. It'll run on a 2 plus and up, I think. Definitely runs under the 2E. It's by a guy named Mike Willigal. I'm not really that familiar with his work. It's basically a remake of an old 1978 ROM board that Apple had produced. It was called the AppleSoft Integer Basic Firmware ROM board that let you switch back and forth between the two sorts of BASICs available for Apples. And that itself is kind of cool. So, because that's a board that's really hard to come by. But the neater thing is it's shipping with something called the Wozniam Pack. And that lets you essentially give your Apple II a lobotomy. So you'll turn it into an Apple I, and a complete clone of the Apple I, in that it'll run like Apple I assembly and that kind of stuff, and disables everything else. You have to get things in through the cassette board and stuff. So if you're interested in Apple I's but don't want to go to the whole route of trying to build your own one of those or something, it's sort of a neat way to turn an Apple II into an Apple I temporarily and get the best of both worlds. One of the downsides is – I don't know if it's a downside, but it's an assemble-yourself sort of unit. So, you know, soldering and all. So it's not really for the hands-off sort of collector. But it's a real item, and it's shipping as of this coming Monday, the March 21st. So it's really cool. I'm gonna pick one up.
It's a fantastic high-resolution scan of the board, isn't it?
Mm-hmm. It just looks like a really cool project. I'm looking forward to playing with it.
And I put another link about Mike's going to some of his other pages. So he's got a lot of other interesting, interesting interests. But then he's got some other stuff here about like an Apple I replica, an Apple II, you know, some other things. So I put another link there too.
It's a good looking at the actual website's actually really nice looking too.
Yeah. So I saw this. I think someone tweeted this recently about the Living Computer Museum. So it's in Seattle. And they had put up some Flickr pictures of computers. So it was just something interesting to look at. So I thought I'd put a link and share it on the show here. So you guys had a chance to look at some of the pictures.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of old iron, as it's called, like a PDP-8 and a 7. Looks like a warehouse building.
Yeah, they've got an Eclipse MV-15000, which is awesome old school computing. It's the kind of thing you could use to decorate with, the big stand-up reel-to-reel computer. It's very cool.
Do either of you know much about this place other than just learning about, you know, from these pictures and all?
I just know that I want to go there. I want to go to there.
I had not heard of it until you sent the link in the show notes.
My wife is in love with Seattle. No, it's totally serious. She wants to totally move to Seattle. Oh, I see. Look, it's part of Vulcan Incorporated. Oh, so that means that this is Paul Allen's place.
That's right.
Oh, okay. I didn't realize that. So
That's how they can keep admission free.
So right. This must be also part of the PDP Planet, I think another website that Paul Allen does, you know, puts up. Which, you know, Paul, the PDP was like the first computer they had access to, you know, him and Bill Gates, when they wrote for the Altair. You know, when they heard about the Altair and they started writing BASIC, they didn't have access to an Altair. So they wrote, or maybe it was just Bill Gates, they wrote an 8080 emulator that ran on the TOPS 10 operating system on a PDP-8. Or a 10, one of those. I don't remember off the top of my head. And that's how they wrote BASIC, or I guess Bill Gates did.
I wonder if that BASIC is available there in the museum to see.
Hmm. Anyway, very nice. Some nice pictures to look at. Definitely these are some computers that there can't be very many of these left in the world, especially to go look at or to see operate, you know, other than maybe the Computer History Museum in California and the Living Computer Museum in Seattle. Well, next I'm going to move to, this is just a site that I was made aware of called s100computers.com. So they have a forum and history and just, you know, a lot of great information if anyone has interest in the S100 computers, which of course are Altairs and M-Size and processor technology and so on.
This sort of stuff, looking at these, brings back a lot of memories from the earliest days of my computing. But like to me, if you relate that era to, say, car collecting, like the S100 era is like having to build your own car from scratch completely,
right,
which was fun and rewarding, and I loved it, a great way to start. But I really got into computers, and I still prefer the slightly later era when you can essentially, keep with the metaphor, buy a car that's already working and then just modify the heck out of it. Not that I was ever actually cool enough to soup up cars. I just like to talk that way.
Well, I understand completely. And yeah, the Apple II definitely made that possible. I mean, along with some other 8-bit computers from the time. But for me, it was the Macintosh, which was completely about software versus hardware in that sense, a closed system.
Right.
Yeah, my early computer excitement and experiences were based on totally what came through the screen.
I was just in it to impress the chicks.
Did that work?
No, that's really not working out for me very well at all.
The next item I wanted to mention was, have either of you heard of Commodore Free? It's a web-based newsletter or magazine. So here we go. Talk about another little magazine. Mm-hmm. This is what 300 Baud could maybe become if they so choose. So this one's been going for quite a while. I think it's 48 that just came out. So it's a downloadable PDF magazine, which is, you know, very Commodore if you're into that.
Mm-hmm. I was taking a look at their latest episode. It's pretty ambitious. A lot of material in there.
A lot of material with that Where Are Things Now and stuff that, yeah, absolutely.
Yes, I highly recommend that, and you can download all the old ones if you like. This one came out in February, probably, I think, early March, actually, you know, for February.
Have you guys heard about the rumor that Apple might release some kind of update to the Xcode to allow magazine, like some kind of template for magazine publishers?
I have heard. That rumor's been going around for a bit now, but it's gotten very strong. Right. It really does seem like there must be something in development or getting seeded out there, because too many people are talking about it.
But that would be perfect for... For groups like this, or
it's
for,
sort of strange that something like that doesn't exist. That there isn't basically a thing in Pages where you can say save as, you know, PDF or save as magazine for an iOS device. Because it doesn't seem like, and they're in such a confrontational relationship right now with Adobe. You think they'd want to do it just out of spite?
James, elaborate a little bit more, because you know, I don't have an iPhone. I've had an Android phone for a while, so I haven't been a real until just now. You know, with my iPad, I don't read a lot of, you know, iOS based magazines or books just yet. So what does it mean?
No,
what do you
standard,
mean?
There's no standard format for magazines, and you know, like Apple did the iBooks for books, and that's fine. You know, love it or hate it, at least there's a standard place you can go. Apple has they have the opportunity of setting some kind of standard for magazines, because right now magazine publishers, they'll either come up with their own individual apps, and so every magazine you have has an individual application.
Okay, that's what I thought.
Or they get lumped into some service like a Zinio.
Right, right.
And so if they had some kind of standard format by which you could subscribe to magazines, they could sort of. I mean, I think it would really take off, especially for hobbyists, especially if they allowed you know, like. Magazines to come out for free.
Yeah, like podcasts and be RSS and so on.
Right.
Yeah, okay. I feel like that is a great idea. All right, another, the Computer History Museum, they'll list this day in history. So a couple of days ago, see, on March 17th, 1988, was the anniversary, I guess, of Apple suing Microsoft for copyright infringement. Apple Computer sues Microsoft Corporation for copyright infringement in its Windows design. After Apple developed a highly successful graphical user interface for its Macintosh computer released in 1984, Microsoft fought back with an operating system of its own called Windows, quote-unquote. In 1995, Apple lost a lawsuit in which it claimed that the similarities of the Windows and Macintosh environments extended too far. So just
Windows.
To mention that.
Windows. It rings a bell. Did that ever take off?
Yeah.
Can you imagine it was in the courts that long?
Right,
it
right.
It was. That was, oh, I remember. Like, that went on forever and ever and ever.
Well, and this is a kind of a over, I mean, it just stated all the facts about that particular aspect of that lawsuit. But, you know, there were other lawsuits going on. This was far more complicated than just this mention here. Because I think Apple also sued HP over, I believe it's called the Wave. And they had issues with Digital Research's Jim. Which then went on to be on like Atari computers with the ST and all that. So, you know, so they had to change what their desktop looked like and their trash can and the way things worked. So, you know, Apple was fighting lots of other companies saying, you can't do this. And I think the general consensus from like Microsoft and some other companies essentially was, you know, Ford can't go around suing all the other car manufacturers just because they all have the same layout of the dashboard.
Yeah, the look and feel lawsuits just didn't end up well for
Apple.
Yeah,
it's just things just kind of come into this is how they work. Mm-hmm. And for now, you just say that nobody else can work it that way. You know, it's the most logical sort of metaphor, right? I think it's what we called that, the desktop metaphor. So that's kind of interesting. I've actually read a lot about this, but it's been years, so I don't remember too much of the details.
And I'm a complete Apple fanboy from their hardware and software from way back. But at the same time, I honestly always felt that the idea that once you have a particular sort of layout or a basic GUI sort of metaphor, to sue people out of being able to use the same thing is just going to stifle innovation and just hurt it, especially when it was based on something that they had seen elsewhere and stuff, and just all seemed a very silly tact. But Apple's not always the nicest company, even though they do produce pretty awesome stuff.
Uh-oh, we're a show of all Apple fanboys.
Yeah.
This was not by design.
Well, let me say I'm glad they lost that lawsuit.
Me too.
Because it worked out in the long run, didn't it?
I mean,
absolutely.
If they had won and Windows got shut down, I mean, imagine where we'd be today. I mean, we wouldn't have nearly the competition, and we'd probably still be using an old version of the Mac OS.
Right. And again, in all seriousness, of course, I'm a very long... using Macintosh person. You know, I'm on my MacBook Pro right now as we do this show, and got my iPad here. You know, so I love Apple products, but I don't hate Windows at all. I'm a Windows tech too, and you know, in all fairness, yeah, has Windows copied some features of the Mac over the years? Sure, but you know, Apple has also copied features from the Windows interface over the years, and in fact, I would argue it's made the Mac OS better in a lot of ways. And then they both have copied features from Linux and X Windows, and you know, a lot of those things have come on strong now, you know, in both operating systems. And then behind the curtain, you know, how things work have been copied from Unix. You know, of course, the Mac is based on Unix somewhat, and then even Windows kind of has a sort of Unix-y-like core, I think, right? you know, just one last thing on this. This reminds me, of course, the movie Pirates of Silicon Valley, which I think was a pivotal scene where Steve Jobs is... introducing the Mac? Is that the scene? And Bill Gates, you know, Steve has him put on an Apple T-shirt, and he's standing like off to the stage. And then while Steve's out on the stage talking to the audience, you know, the Apple employees have now they ordered a computer from Japan that had Windows 1.0 on it. Mm-hmm. Do you guys remember this?
Yes.
And then Steve's all ticked off, and then finally Bill Gates pulls the shirt off and, you know, tells him off, I guess, for the first time about, you know, you don't get it, Steve. And what's the one thing he said, like, I think it was in this part where, you know, you broke into Xerox's house to find that, you know, to steal the television, to find that we'd already been there and stolen the VCR. And now you say it's unfair or something like that.
That'll get you for trying to cross Anthony Michael Hall.
You know, I saw him recently. My wife was watching the show and he was on it. He was like a bad guy on, the guy's really bulked up. I almost didn't recognize him. I mean, he's like a real thick kind of big guy now.
He couldn't play Bill Gates now.
Oh, right. Oh, yeah, he almost doesn't look like himself. And, you know, that movie was, I think, in 97. So, oh, boy, he looks dramatically different now. All right, well, our last topic here, we are going to talk about emulators today. So, James, we were talking a little before the show. So you've been covering, you guys have been covering emulators on the Retro MacCast.
We do. We talk a lot about emulators because, you know, while it's nice to have the original hardware, sometimes that's not practical. Either you can't get it. You can't afford it, or maybe you don't have the space for it. And even, you know, working with old hardware can be tricky, even if you have it. Get the right formats and the right software. So emulation certainly allows you to bypass all that. So, yeah, there's a lot. I mean, we could spend the whole show talking about emulators. But recently I've been playing with emulators for the iPad, notably ActiveGS, which... It's being sold in the iTunes store as a demonstration package.
Right.
But it turns out you can dig into there if you know what you're doing and put your own images in there and actually run it like a full up Apple IIgs.
Have you had any problems with it?
I haven't. No. Well, I mean, I've only played with it a bit, you know. I mean, it's not like I'm going to start using it as a regular computer or anything, but.
And it's called the Best of FTA. At least that's what my icon is called here. Is
yeah,
that right?
Tools Association.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
Okay. Well, do you have any other favorite? Well, I think I can answer that, James. I think one of your favorites is Mini VMac.
It is. That's a great one. At least on your Mac or PC. And then you can run it on iOS, but you got to do a little jailbreaking to do that.
And I have Mini VMac. In fact, I was trying to get an old game to run recently, and it wasn't working, so I need to... And I think you guys mentioned on your show where you can go and get some different images that already have different operating systems, so I need to check that out.
Right, over at MacintoshGarden.org, one of the guys over there has uploaded a bunch of disk images that include different operating systems. It even includes the ROM, so I don't know how long that will be up there, but normally... ROMs aren't distributed openly.
Yeah, no. Right. You usually got to grab them separately.
Yeah.
The two emulators that I use most are really Mac emulators to emulate Apple II systems. And I like Sweet 16 for the 2GS and Virtual 2 to emulate standard Apple IIs. Both those are really good and solid emulators.
Okay. I guess you don't emulate any Commodores, huh?
No.
Go ahead, James.
Oh, no, I was just going to mention the other good emulator for the Mac is Sheep Shaver.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, yeah. Good choice, yeah.
And I've heard you guys talk about that one a number of times, and I just haven't gotten around to trying it out. With Sheep Shaver, you can do up to OS 9, right?
Right. That's right.
I need to get on the ball. Now,
The other thing I use, which I guess is an emulator, is one of my favorite ways to get at Apple II stuff, though. If you want to run, like, you know, real software on real disks and stuff, you might grab from eBay. I like my Apple II card. I have it at an LC475, but it'll run in most LC systems.
That's
so
cool.
An old Mac pizza box type thing, like an old LC. The 2E card is a great way to run real software.
And, of course, that's a real 2E, I think, right?
It is. In a sense, it's really more of a 2C emulator, if you think about it, because you've got no slots or anything. Mm-hmm. But it runs perfectly well, 100% compatible, has like a little Y cable that's important to get that comes with it, and then that lets you plug in the external disk drives, so you get the 5 1/4 drives, and also it splits off to give you a joystick connector as well. What's nice about it is it's really easy to get things in and out of it because you're sitting on top of a full Mac. So it's going to have a hard drive, and it's really simple. It's a great way to take screenshots because that's built in. I use that a lot for taking the screenshots of the stuff that I review on 1 MHz.
Excellent. There was before I had an iPad, because I listen to a lot of other podcasts too, and I remember this coming up somewhere, but there, I think it was called iDOS for the iPhone and iPad.
Sure. And I got that on that limited availability when it was out for that really small period.
Me too.
Oh, you guys got it?
Yeah, I grabbed it immediately because I knew that wasn't staying up there.
Yeah, so there's no way to get it now, period.
Well,
right?
Unless you jailbreak.
Right. I mean, there's no way that someone could send a file to me and I could get it into my iTunes and put it on my iPad because you have to get it through the store.
Correct.
Yeah. You know, I saw where someone, I think, had ran Windows 3.1 on it.
Uh-huh.
Not that I necessarily want to do that, but it was kind of cool. I still understand why Apple is so hard. Why do they care so much about that?
It's the running of other code, I think. I think they worry, oh, goodness, you're going to run something that's going to get us sued, or you'll run something that wouldn't have been approved, or you'll run something that'll introduce a security flaw. I don't think that could happen in this case, but I think that's what's going on there. It's a blanket, you know, you can't emulate stuff policy.
Mm-hmm. That's why this ActiveGS, I'm like surprised it's still on.
Well, it doesn't really let you run anything you want. I'm a little surprised as well. I thought it might get pulled, but I guess there is a difference there.
It's not designed to do that.
Right, yeah.
Right, James?
It's not designed. You can if you know what you're doing, you can. Yeah, there's also a I don't know what happened to it. I remember seeing pictures of a Newton emulator for iOS.
Oh, yeah. I thought I remember hearing something about that, too.
That would have been awesome. I'd love to turn my iPhone into a Newton. That'd be great.
I'll have to go back and see how that's progressing, or if it's even out.
Let's see. Here's a Macworld article from us from last year, September 20th.
Who's interested in anything that old?
A developer named Paul Guyot has released an open source project called Einstein to run the Newton OS. And then developer Stephen Frank of Panic Software got Einstein running on his iPad.
There you go.
Nice. Panic is a great company.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I keep meaning to, or I mentioned it in last show, where they have these retro boxes that look like Atari 2600 boxes with really cool artwork on them. So I've been meaning to, I'm trying to remember to order some of those, just to put on my shelves. Well, here's something about the Einstein. Newton OS running on other operating systems. Open Einstein. Currently runs on Mac OS 10, iPhone, iPod, and iPad running iOS, but I guess you have to jailbreak currently. So, all right, well, I'll put a link here. Well, the show is flying by. I guess that's good. Last show was, oh my God, almost 2 hours.
It was long, split up files, yes.
So we're going to move on to the eBay auctions. And so we'll quickly review last show's auctions. And the first one was from Matt from Boring Beige Box. And it is a Dell Dimension XPS. So it's a 486DX266. And it has not sold, even with free shipping. But $299.99, which is a little high, definitely. But, you know, the guy said it's refurbished, guy or gal, and it's all nice and clean and packaged up. So if you really wanted a gaming 486, you know, at least you know you're getting something that would be great shape and work well. So that didn't sell. The next item is from Evan, and Mits Altair 8800, a rare early version. No, it didn't sell, though. Yeah, the seller had zero feedback.
Oh, yeah, I was worried about that.
Oh, you know what, though? The seller is in Floyd, Virginia, and I'm trying to think of the gentleman's name that lives there. This has to be that same guy, I would think. Darn, what is his name?
Certainly a lot of great pictures.
Yeah, it's tough on eBay if you have to develop your feedback somehow. So it's tough to ding somebody if they don't have anything, if they're just starting. But at the same time, I think it's more if somebody's very far on the other side of the planet for me, and I worry more if they have zero feedback, because I think what will I do?
I found the gentleman I was talking about, and he's a very big collector. It's called the LCF Group, Floyd, Virginia. Oh, David Larson. I wonder if that might have been him, but in any case, it didn't sell. It had a starting bid of $1,750, or it looks like a buy it now at $2,178, which, I mean, isn't crazy by any means for being a fantastic, condition original Altair.
Mm-hmm.
I think, like a lot of things, you could find it cheaper if you really watched eBay regularly, and that's what you wanted to find. If you're patient and you watch, you can find always find a better deal. The next item was from Earl Evans, and it was a Teletype Model 33.
Earl Evans, never heard of him.
And it sold for $274.50 with one bid. Ooh, this would be shipping to me, but $130. This is in Knoxville, Tennessee.
Oh, I bet the shipping would be higher to Canada. Kills us on eBay things.
Or other parts of the U.S., considering Tennessee isn't that far from Georgia. Okay, so that's sold. And the last thing... last time I cheated again, so I don't really need to bring it up. I didn't cheat this time, by the way, but I just basically just used the search term Zenith in the vintage computer category.
There are cool things in that category, though.
Yeah. And just flipping through it real quick, looks like there's a number of things here that are still there. And I know there was a couple that were, ridiculously priced.
Gosh, I remember using Zenith computers in college.
Uh-huh. Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I was in the Army for a while back in the early 90s, and I remember the Army used Zenith computers quite a bit. Because I remember my company commander in Germany had a Zenith laptop on his desk.
Yeah, I had a Zenith desktop for a while, but it was actually a Heathkit.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah,
and I remember Heathkit stores and all.
Mm-hmm.
So now moving into this show's auctions, we'll start off with you, Carrington.
Jupiter Ace. I selected the Jupiter Ace, yeah. A pretty rare computer. I think there was only 8,000 or 10,000 of those ever even made. It's not as rare as the next model. There was a Jupiter Ace 4000, and it definitely sold far less than 4,000 units. It's something like 1K or something like that. What's cool about the Jupiter, I think, that makes it collectible and makes it sort of fun as an idea, something to have, is, first of all, for the era, it uses fourth instead of basic. So that's sort of rare on its own. It's designed by the same people that did the ZX81. And then this was a different project. They named after the earlier Ace computer, sort of famous in Britain. Other things that were cool about it is it has a full dedicated 2K of video RAM instead of being shared. So there's a full 1K left for programs. And it was expandable to 50K, which is just massive for something that was a 1983 computer or something like that. It has no color. So that's a bit of a downside, and I think was one of the reasons why it sold so poorly. And it was a diskless system when it shipped. It was just cassette-based, and I think that hurt it as well because it went into the disk era in the next year. But lots of expansion things were available and still are, so you can still get RAM for it. You can get disk drives for it. You can get tons of things. Being a UK-based system, you have to think about the power supply and video out and stuff. But a very open system where it's easy to get power supplies, off-the-shelf ones that will power it. And it's really easy to convert PAL stuff nowadays, and most TVs will just take it. So they're neat. They're very, very collectible. I rarely see them. I don't look for them, though, so maybe I'm wrong, and they're up every week. But I haven't seen a Jupiter in forever, so I thought it was a really interesting thing.
Couldn't you also convert the video into a flat panel display?
Sure.
And that would solve that problem, too?
Oh, absolutely. It's the kind of system that you could get in North America and have it be fully usable very easily.
Yeah, I can see the similarities of its look, sort of to a Timex, American version,
well,
Timex
is,
Sinclair.
Yeah.
But then it has the Spectrum keys on it, which in the Wikipedia article, it says the two guys, Jupiter Kintab was formed by Richard Altwasser and Stephen Vickers. Both had been on the design team for the Sinclair ZX Spectrum. And one of the guys did development on the ZX81. ZX81.
Yes, for us Brits. And they went with fourth because fourth is fully threaded and stuff. So as far as I know, fourth was the first IDE. is the way I remember it exactly. So it's one of these things where for the time, like the Jupiter was many times faster for executing things than the equivalent basic systems at the time. So it's a very neat and low selling but very usable computer. So it's an interesting retro piece. So just that was my pick for this week.
And it's got a little over 4 hours left as of our recording session. Yeah. Well, it's got 19 bids, and it's at £310, which is, it says, approximately $501. So, I mean, it's fetching a pretty good sum.
Yeah, they do. They're very rare, and they do normally sell because they're so usable. It's not just a shelf piece. It's something you can get and actively play with. They're a very fun computer to have. So I think they usually fetch fairly high prices.
And I'm very familiar with the name and its look. I mean, I know I've seen it and heard of it plenty of times over the years, but just have never been very familiar with it otherwise. You know,
don't. Yeah, so it's neat to get a fourth system. It's nicer keys than the other ones. It's more expandable. You can put a lot of RAM in it. So it's a fun system. I should admit that my first choice for the eBay auction was something totally different, but it was a buy it now thing, and I bought it. So
what was that?
A fellow in Europe had a still sealed Infocom suspense one with the mask.
Are you serious?
Yeah, and it was only £49.
Oh, man.
£10 shipping. And so I was like, you know what? No, I'm sorry. I'm taking it. So I bought it.
Carrington, that thing is worth at least.
I know. It's shrink wrapped. And listeners of 1 MHz will be able to listen to me open it up because that's what I do. I'm very excited about it.
No.
Oh, yeah. I'm taking that fucking day off.
No kidding. I mean, that is the most collectible Infocom. Correct me if I'm wrong. I mean, that is the.
Well, the Flying Saucer
Holy Grail.
One is a huge one as well. But I've always wanted a mask box. And it's in pretty good shape. There's a little hole in the shrink wrap, but it's all still originally sealed. So I'm really excited. And it's an Infocom game I haven't played either. So
I mean,
I'm 40, very, very keen on it.
So how many pounds total?
It was £49 and £10 shipping. So 59 pounds total.
I mean, so that's what, $100 maybe?
Yeah, about $100.
Sorry,
so
I'm making an American.
It was a screaming deal. I was like, oh my goodness, I'll just take that.
So U.S. dollars, because, you know, the whole world revolves around the United States.
Well,
course,
our
so
dollar's pretty
it.
Much at par now. So I was just really excited. So I was looking, I was like, oh no, I'm just going to take that.
I mean, so just continuing the reference in dollars then, I mean, come on, easily, that thing's got to be worth at least $300, maybe way more than that?
I think they normally go $300 and up depending on the condition. Lots of times, the masks cracked a lot. This one has a small crack near the eye. A lot of times the masks are in very, very bad shape, and even those ones will go $300 or so if they're still sealed. And one in great condition is usually $500 and up, which I think is sort of ridiculous for a game. But they're just, you know, such a collectible item, and Infocom games remain popular. It depends what system they're for as well, though. Like early Infocom games for PCs are very much more collectible usually than for other systems. This was the Apple II version, of course. So it was perfect for me. I'm really excited about it.
Suspended is my favorite Infocom game, by the
way,
good. Too.
Oh, good. I look forward to playing it.
Oh, you never played it? Yeah. It's
pretty neat. Yeah. I played a lot of them, but not that one. So I'm very keen.
James, are you familiar with that game at all?
I have not played that game, no. I'm reading about it right now.
Carrington, are you familiar with the premise or the storyline of it?
Oh, sure, yeah. I'm a huge Infocom fan, so I'm sort of aware of the games, but I've only played a handful of them all the way through.
Well, not to stay on this too long, because we went off, but it's such a great topic. But just real quick, I guess, for our listeners, let's see. And you helped me out, Carrington. So I think the basic premise is... it's like a city. Is it on another planet that's controlled by computers? Like the environment, everything's controlled, and then it had a breakdown, and a lot of people died. And so moving forward, they said never again will allow everything to be controlled by computers. Therefore, we need to have one person who is put in suspended animation so that if something goes wrong, that person could be awakened to control the systems.
Yeah, he's like the central mentality or whatever I think it was called or something. Yeah.
Right. And so basically, you're that person, and then all of a sudden you find that you've been awoken because there's something going on in the complex. And basically, only your mind becomes awakened, not your body fully, at least in the beginning.
Right, and you're controlling robots, I guess, that you move around. But don't tell me how it ends, because I haven't played it yet.
Oh, yeah. I never finished it. But they all have special abilities, a different rope. One's called Auda, I think, for audible, you know, sound. And one is Iris, and... they all have different special features or whatever. So the premise is just great. To me, it'd make a fantastic sci-fi movie, I think.
I'm really, really looking forward to getting it and playing it. So, and what's nice is it's the eBay seller had, you know, 2,000 feedback or something like that with 100%. So I'm really confident I'll actually get the unit. So I'm really keen.
And just a last thing to mention is the guy that wrote that, which I can't remember his name, but he's in GitLamp. You know, he's one of the people Jason Scott interviews because he wrote, you know, he has a whole feature in there about Infocom.
Mm-hmm.
So
GitLamp was a really fun documentary.
Okay, so James, we'll move to you and your eBay item.
Okay. This is one that's been sitting out there for a long time, and I haven't talked about it on Retro MacCast because, I don't know. It's one of those weird ones where, yeah, it's really rare, and the seller wants like a ridiculous amount of money. This is an Apple Lisa 1 Theory of Operations / Hardware Manual dated in 1982. And it looks to be, it's like a final draft of a Lisa 1 hardware manual, and it's in a three-ring binder sort of thing, and it's a bunch of Xerox pages in there. And it's certainly, it's got to be rare, but the seller wants a buy it now of $999.99,
yeah,
which is a lot of money. But it's an interesting, just to look at the pictures, though, to see the contents of it. And there's hand-drawn pictures in there. So this is definitely, you know, pre-production sort of thing. And it was, looks like it was written by, like it was contracted out to Forrest Worthman and Associates. Final draft, September 7th, 1982. The author is D. Barry. Hmm. I know in the early days of Apple, you know, when they were still growing, they did a lot of contract work for technical documentation. So that's likely what they did. But I don't think it's going to sell anytime soon.
But it does sound like a very rare piece, though. I don't know about the $1,000, but I've never seen one of these.
Sure. Yeah, it would be great in a museum someplace.
Mm-hmm.
I was looking at the person, Maple Ridge Auctions.
Yes.
And they've got 5,261 feedback with 100%. So, woo, they've been at it for quite a while. And just looking at some of their, they have 152 things listed right now. And they have, most of these are in vintage computing, some of their other stuff. So, like, they have a vintage Apple Lisa 1 computer 5.25-inch Twiggy disk for $29.99. Buy it now. And, some games and other, like, some Apple II cards and stuff. Some Apple pins.
Yeah, this seller often has some rare items. And often they're priced a little high. So, you know, there's kind of waiting for the right person to come along, I guess.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And I know you and John have talked about this, and we've talked about this on this show, panelists here, about this is one of the particular type of there's people that, you know, it might take months, but if they're not, you know, if the person selling isn't in a hurry to get the money, then they have nothing to lose than to just wait. Maybe, you know, it's worth a shot, you know, versus me selling this now for $300. If I can get three times that much just by being more patient, that one person could say, oh, I really want this, and they've got the $1,000 that isn't that much to them.
I guess if something particularly isn't a truly rare item, unlike everything on eBay with the word rare beside it, but if something truly is rare and collectible, it should appreciate in value. So you could essentially pick the number you want to sell for, and then you simply wait. Maybe it'll take 6 months, maybe it'll take 6 years.
Oh, and you know, just the last thing on this the seller, and James, you know, I saw this, I believe it's the same one. I saw this recently, and I meant to email it to you and John. I thought you might want to mention it on your show, but the seller is also selling a vintage Sharp Expert Pad, rare Apple Newton clone, 1993. And that's got to buy it now for $499.99.
Wow.
Which I have one of those.
Oh.
That would be kind of interesting. I don't really want to sell mine, but wow, is it worth $500? Do you know what that is?
That's, yes.
Yeah, from the original Newton, because Sharp made them, and that's the only time Apple allowed, you know, the manufacturer to make a version of it. Mm-hmm. So it basically looks like the original Newton, but it has a lid that folds around the back, and the stylus goes inside the lid next to the screen as well. So pretty cool.
I don't know about when Apple lets other people make their stuff, you end up with the Bandai Pippin and the Motorola Rocker, and like, not always the best moves by Apple.
I wonder if offhand, James, do you know this, whether after that original Newton, did Sharp keep on making them, or did Apple?
I don't remember.
Yeah, I don't know if, you know, who, I know the 110 looked different, very different, and then the 120 about the same, but All right. Well, hey, good item. Very interesting. So we'll, you know, next show we'll follow up on this and see what happens. We'll steal from the Retro Metcast here, and I predict it won't sell.
Yeah, I share that.
At least not in the next 3 weeks, or 2 weeks in this case, till next show. All right, well, that's... oh, wait, I have one. Huh. Well, let's move to my auction then. In recent years, you know, I've moved around a lot, and I don't really acquire large computers. I mean, I have, but for the most part, I don't try to acquire large computers as much anymore because of space limitations and so on. So a number of years ago, I chose to start collecting handhelds. And like I mentioned, the Sharp Expert Pad, I have a collection of Newtons and little HP handhelds in the Atari portfolio and things like this. And this is actually one I've been meaning to add to my collection for quite a long time. It's the Scion Organizer. And in this case, this one's in, I guess it's in Great Britain. Yeah, because it's in pounds. So it's the Scion Series 3C, 2 megabytes backlit screen. So it's an interesting device. I believe this is around, let me see, does it say in the auction, 1994, 95 sometime? You know, the Newton kind of set the pace of this new handheld sort of technology, the PDA. And I think, it kind of failed. It didn't really take off in quite a way to establish what I called a third tier. You had your desktops, your laptops, and then you didn't really have a true handheld like we do now with an iPhone, iPad. Where it's almost a true computer replacement, or you know, you can do almost as much with it. So I think ultimately the PDA kind of failed, and it kind of devolved into the Palm, you know, into the organizer. And so then you kind of had a little bit of a renaissance with the Sharp Wizard and some of those things. And this is what this was. This was in that category. One thing interesting about this particular one is if you look in the description, the person describes it, says the rubber coating on the Scion has gone sticky, so we have removed it, leaving a plain plastic finish, and then otherwise the screen is excellent condition. And I thought it was interesting because I have had this happen on a few different devices over the years, and one was an Amstrad pin pad, which was a Newton wannabe, sort of like the Zoomer. Are either of you guys familiar with that?
No, I haven't heard of that.
So it looked a lot like the original Newton, and you know, had a touch screen, you know, same sort of thing. But actually, I've had two over the years, and in both times, the same exact thing happened where just through storage or it was really just nasty. It just turned into this really sticky, kind of gooey, the rubber coating on the cases. And so it's kind of interesting that was also an English-made device, and so is this one. So I wonder if it had something to do with that manufacturing process in England, you know, at the time. Maybe this wasn't all that interesting.
The Scion it's an interesting time in the 80s where a lot of things were coming out really shooting for the fence and going for a lot of functionality the way the Newton did.
Yeah.
And then
90s though.
Sort of getting but then getting sort of beaten up by simpler technologies. I mean, I remember so many times, really back as far as I remember railing against fax machines at the time, saying, why would you do this? Why would you print out an item and then fax somebody a low-resolution copy that they have to type in? There's a way I can send this data. Just this is what modems are. Please stop it. And just, you know, you strip out a lot of functionality and just make it very, very simple for people to use. And frequently that wins out over something more capable but more complicated.
And I think this is exactly what happened with the Palm Pilot. It kind of... simplified. It did way less things. It wasn't as ambitious, but it did. It was better form factor, smaller. But the least, you know, the little number of things it did well. Contact. It was a PIM, right? A personal information manager. Contact list, to do, and what else am I thinking of? Calendar.
And there'd usually be some little databasey type thing that would be your backing all those. And yeah, it's interesting that Apple sort of learned that lesson, having got their butt handed to them by Palm in the Newton thing. Mm-hmm. But Apple's successes have always come from doing exactly that, releasing products that, like, people would talk about the iPod saying, why would you get this? It doesn't have can't get FM. You can't record your own stuff. You can't, but it did less, but it did it really well. It would try to do, you know, just what 90% of the people wanted 90% of the time and do that perfectly. And that's all. And they've always found more success in that, it seems. So,
and you know, the whole Apple Newton topic is a huge topic in itself. It's there's a lot of interesting aspects to that, because of course this was after and before Steve Jobs, you know, in the company. This was John Sculley's project, and it was based on the Knowledge Navigator. So, in fact, the Newton, as it turned out, was a dummy-down Knowledge Navigator. It didn't even live up to its original intention of being a true third-tier computing platform that could be, you know, accentuate the laptop desktop. You know, it didn't really live up to what it needed to do, and so it cost too much, too big. So, Carrington, when I see you at the Vintage Computer Festival, I'm actually displaying as well, so I'll have a table, and the theme of my display is some presentations I've done here locally to user groups. It's called What is the Third Tier? Nice. And it's basically this sort of history of how the third tier struggled to come into existence and ultimately failed and dummied down into the handheld organizer. And then ultimately with the, and what I feel like with the smartphone is what re-energized that platform. And then ultimately with the, you know, the iPhone and then the iPad.
Absolutely. I remember the very first time I saw an iPhone, it was the first time I thought, here is a potential new type of computer that could really take off, like as a computer, because my thought at the time was, this thing is powerful enough that why can't it be, like, not at the time, but I thought, well, 5 years from now, won't this be able to be my computer? If we're going to have, at the time, everyone was talking about wireless HD broadcast over near, which, you know, we've only just got now, just to go from, like, say, your DVD to your TV without a cable. But at the time, I was thinking, if we can do that, if I can broadcast video, why can't I just have my thing in my pocket, which is my phone, but it's also my computer, and I sit down at simply a keyboard and mouse, and everything is just transmitted from this thing in my pocket. How convenient. So it was funny how it was the first little consumer device that I thought, oh, here's a potential completely different way to go that could be another thing, like a third tier, another computer. So I was thinking along the exact same lines. It hasn't really played out the way I thought it would in the details, but it has become essentially a third tier. My iOS devices are the other way I compute now.
Right. This brings up other, you know, considerations or discussions. If, like, is the iPad a fourth tier, or is it just an extension of the third tier? I tend to lean that it's a, for lack of any better simplification, you know, it's a bigger iPhone. You know, it's still kind of part of that third tier. But you know, one last thing about this is I think in my mind, the iPhone was the first true smartphone, in my opinion, because it was the first smartphone. Yeah, there were smartphones you could check your email and surf the web on before it. But the iPhone, in my opinion, was the first one where it really gave you the web experience just like a real computer.
Mm-hmm. It was
an email experience. James, you have strong opinions, I imagine, on this.
I'll agree with that.
I have a bunch of old Mac Weeks looking back on them. If you were to go in 1994, 95 and ask people, what's the one feature your Newton is missing? What's the one feature you wish your handheld Newton or whatever could have? What would it be? And what do you think people said?
App Store.
No.
They were very prescient.
A phone.
Interesting.
And there were even some other Newton devices, one by Motorola and a couple other companies, where they added a cellular phone to it. But I think what the turnaround was is people kind of always thought that the computer would continue to get smaller and it would become a phone sooner or later, right? And actually kind of the opposite happened, arguably. The phone became the computer. So really starting with the Trio 180, the first kind of Palm phone, in that case the PDA became the phone. But you see what I'm saying? That phones drove the procession of becoming computers versus the other way around.
And also with the iPhone, it was the first one for me, first one in my experience, where it was all about interface. It was essentially a screen. So it wasn't that this is a phone with a little screen on it, or this is, like, even the BlackBerry, here's a keyboard and a little monitor. This was, no, here's a monitor, and it's a view into what it can do and can morph into so many things. And that just opened it up completely. And I think that's why most smartphones that come out now are the exact same thing. It is a screen that you hold.
Mm-hmm. This has turned into an Apple show.
We had some Commodore links. I may have booed. If people didn't hear that, you must have edited it out.
James, I feel like you're disappointed. You get this all the time.
I'm sorry, I've been a little quiet because I got diverted here when you start talking about suspended.
Oh yeah.
And I wanted to say, okay, well, I want to get a copy, and so I went over to Macintosh Garden and downloaded a copy, and I was looking at some of the information there, and it turns out that there's this emulator I had not heard of. Have either of you heard of Zoom?
Of course, yeah.
Yeah, the Z machine, right?
All right. Well, it's new to me, and so I now have suspended running in Zoom right now. So
nice.
Is that called the Z machine?
Well, I say Z machine, but yes, but it is a Z machine emulator. So it'll run the Infocom stuff plus other things Because there's still a large number of people, well, large in quotes, people producing this sort of game using the same languages and stuff. So it'll run those as well. For me, Infocom games are a lot about the feelies as well, though. Like, I like having the packaging for those. A lot of other games, I'll just be just as happy to play them with the, which is funny considering Infocom has no graphics. I mean, it's literally just all text. So they're sort of perfect to run in emulation. Mm-hmm. But I do like holding the packaging and playing with the little feelies that come with it.
And I'm adding a link here for everyone's information. If you go to this link, play Infocom Adventures Online.
Oh, nice.
So here you go. Here's a bunch of Infocom games that you can play. And there's some links here to a lot of great stuff about Infocom.
Infocom games really have held up for me over the years. Like, you can play them 25 years later and they are just as engrossing as they were back then. Like, they, such great writing in most mm-hmm. of them.
Well, I think just like a good book can hold up. I mean, it's interactive fiction, right? Or mm-hmm. text adventures.
Just, it's the level of production, though, the level of writing and storytelling in those is so far beyond most other adventure games. I mean, even ones that come out now, it's crazy how well produced those were.
Hey, we're done good. Hour and 18 minutes. I've debated about having just three people on the show versus four. So in some respects,
just as long with just three of us.
You know, and then with editing, I mean, so I don't know. It's kind of, the flow has been real good here. But we should argue more.
I can be contentious. I'll happily be
contentious. So I want to thank both of you guys again. So it's Carrington Vanston of 1 MHz, the Apple II podcast. Is there anything else you'd like to add, Carrington?
Well, no, other than it's just an Apple II podcast.
An Apple II.
Well, because it's funny because the first couple of episodes, I did call it the Apple II podcast because there wasn't another one out there. But there's now a few. Including there's a new podcast mm-hmm. out called
Open Apple.
Something of Kansas Fest. No, there's a Kansas Fest one.
That's it.
Which I've really enjoyed. They have, I think, just two episodes out so far or something. But yeah, so it's nice. It's the more vintage podcasts, the better, I think.
And also, thank you, James Savage of Retro Maccast. Not the, but it is the Retro Maccast.
Yeah, RetroMaccast.com. Coming up on our big 200th episode.
You guys are doing something special then, our video again?
Probably. I just haven't had the time to put
it's a pain,
any thought
huh?
to it. Yeah. Yeah, video is just, it's an order of magnitude more mm-hmm. more preparation and more production. So I don't know. I feel like I owe it to everybody, but I haven't decided yet what
you
exactly.
You owe us. Do it.
Yeah. Well, thanks, guys.
Mm-hmm. Sure.
It's good talking to you again, and I'll talk to you again really soon.
All right. Bye. Bye.
That was show 8, recorded on March 19th. I'm sorry it took so long to be edited and posted, but I hope you enjoyed it. Let's just say life happens, and it gets in the way sometimes. That is, it gets in the way with projects and hobbies. My personal life, family, job, etc., is not in the way. I'm doing the air quotes with my fingers. So, some important news to announce. The show is going on hiatus. Regular listeners already noticed that, I guess. I canceled all recording sessions going forward for now. It could be permanent, but my intent is that it is temporary. I will try to bring the RCR back essentially intact, as a great show I think myself and others see it to be. It's a good formula and format. Though I'd gotten worse with the time and editing, especially lately, I had developed a decent track record of producing them. The thing is, I have spread myself too thin. I haven't updated my blog, nor produced a classic computing video podcast, nor completed Chapter 4 of Stan Beat's book podcast. I have one other big project I must make a priority to. So here's my list. First, I will finally complete and post Chapter 4 of Stan Beat's History of the Personal Computer audiobook podcast. It's very important to me, and I made a commitment to the man before his death. I want to complete the entire book, even if it goes slowly. If you've never listened to the book podcast, please do so, and give a read to my blog article, Remembering Stan Beat. He was an interesting man, and his story is a good one. Plus, the stories he told of the early days of the microcomputer and of his computer store are fantastic. Next, I am going to take the 9 issues of the little magazine he used to publish, Historically Brewed, and put them into a book. The book will also include the 1 incomplete issue of Classic Computing, plus a dozen or so pages of my story. I have been approved for a Kickstarter.com project, so I will be launching that very soon. Please check my blog soon for the details, plus a free copy of HB Issue 1. Lastly, I've had a new episode of Classic Computing, the video podcast, planned forever. So I want to do that. It will just mostly be a show-and-tell show, each about 10 minutes long. Thanks again, everyone, for listening and for your support. Look for the discussed links in the show notes. I would again like to thank this show's panelists, Carrington Vanston and James Savage, plus my heartfelt thanks to all of the previous panelists. I need to also say that I will not be attending the Vintage Computer Festival East this year, so you should consider doing so, especially if you've never been. It is looking to be the largest and best one yet. It will be held at the Info Age Science Center in Wall, New Jersey, on Saturday, May 14th and Sunday, May 15th. See the show notes for a link. Please read my blog and follow everything I'm doing at classiccomputing.com. I'd love to hear from you too, so email me at david@classiccomputing.com.